I'm here, and welcome everyone, to the Deepest Lore with my very special guest, Mr. D.
Very nice to be here, Kermit the agent.
Yes, also joined by Panama Hat.
Hello, everybody.
So, the last Muppet show review that we did proved to be fairly popular with those people who watched it. Before we get into it, though, as a YouTube partner, I think it's my public duty to inform everybody watching this show that the Associated Press has called the presidential election for Joe Biden, and all 50 states have certified. And everybody's got a note that they have to inform everybody of those details. So, with that said, let us get on with the show, and we're going to be talking about the Muppets. Now, last week, we went through some of the guests, some of the celebrity guests, and gave assessments of them. And we went through what I would describe as the main cast. So we covered Kermit, Miss Piggy, Fozzie, Gonzo, and Rolf. Did we do Scooter as well? Not really.
I don't think we did Scooter. No.
So now we've got, according to this, there are Scooter is a main character, as is Animal, Pepe the King of Prawn, Rizzo the Rat, and Walter.
Yeah. Now I must lodge a complaint. Pepe the King Prawn is not canon because he was introduced after the death of Jim Henson. So you remember my criteria for official canon is anything that was produced before the death of Jim Henson in 1990. Oh. And he was an innovation in the late 1990s, I think. So
he's not included. I have to confess that when I read that name, Pepe the King Prawn, I did not picture the character that I'm looking at now. I was thinking of another character who looks a bit like a prawn, who's got like a kind of, I don't know if he is a prawn, but he looks like one to me. And he's got a kind of mustache, and he's maybe even got a bit of a band with him. I'm not sure the name of that character, but he's definitely been in these shows, and I thought he was a prawn.
I'm trying to think of who that could be. I have pictures of almost all of them that we're going to go through. So if you see him, let me know, and I'll tell you who it is.
Yeah, he's kind of a scruffy character. The one I had in mind, and I managed to watch another couple of episodes. I watched the Mark Hamill one in its entirety, and I was quite amused by the fact that a subplot of that is that they're struggling to find Mark Hamill's skills. Oh, this is the character I was. This is the character I was talking about. I'll show you just before we get into it. This is the chap. I thought he was a prawn.
Apparently, Lou Zealand.
That's Lou Zealand. Yes. I don't know what. I mean, he is like many of the Muppets, of an indeterminate animal or indeterminate creature. So we don't know really what he is, but. Yes, I don't know that he's a prawn,
Well, he was the guy I was thinking of with a moustache who crops up quite a lot. Okay, so and then we've got a whole bunch of supporting characters according to this list. I mean, is there a better list I can get? Maybe there's a Muppet Show.
I made an extensive list which I separated into sort of subcategories based upon kind of grouping and importance. So we should use my list if you
yes, okay.
If that's all right.
How should I order it? It's ordered like A to Z. Is that right? So
I have a text file, unfortunately, on my computer here. So how about we I'll just sort of bring it up the next one, and you can find the picture.
Absolutely, let's do it that way then. So who is the next character that we want to have a look at?
Well, I think the next character would be Scooter. So we mentioned him when we came in, and
I'll get him up. Here he is, Scooter.
So Panama Had, perhaps you'd like to start with Scooter.
Well, in terms of his sort of most basic function, if he has one, he is the quote unquote gopher of the theater, which basically means he goes for coffee. It only really works if you have an American accent, but he sort of goes for, coffee or whatever. And he gets some sort of moments throughout the Muppet Show that show him to be a sort of like, sometimes he's meant to be like this 15-year-old kid who's, you know, got like a week off from school and he's sort of just hanging around the theater because his uncle owns it. And at other times he's sort of this university sort of Harvard College type sort of kid. Very, very much sort of New Yorker, it would seem, as well.
So the essential part of Scooter's character, as Panama Hat said, is that his biography is that he is the nephew of the man who owns the Muppet Theater. And there's a file on there called J.P. Gross and Scooter, and you'll see that's the uncle, and he's kind of the perfect sort of caricature of the kind of capitalist type there.
Well, I mean, he literally is J.P. Morgan. That is what J.P. Morgan looked like.
Yeah, I mean, cause right down to the discolored large nose and such. Yeah. Just as a side note, the one thing that sort of impressed me rewatching all these Muppet shows is how they don't shy away from using real fire. And so if you notice in that picture, his cigar is actually a real cigar that's lit. And in one of the episodes that we watched, I mean, he literally is holding a burning cigar.
Now, I noticed that occasionally Scooter is backstage rehearsing for an act that he has. So in the Mark Hamill episode, I think he's playing some little number because he has a number in the show. Is that a normal thing for Scooter to get on stage, or is he usually just backstage?
He's normally
backstage, but they all get on stage at one time or another. Like I think sort of every character eventually has a kind of song or sort of participates in a kind of number on the stage. So yes, I mean he's mainly kind of in his role, but he like the janitors and everyone else in the theater, eventually he does end up on the stage from time to time. So
now do you two like Scooter? You don't seem to be that enthusiastic about him as a character.
I don't really like Scooter. No, I don't know about you, Panama.
I'm kind of lukewarm on Scooter because I think he has a character that, again, like some of the others we talked about last week, that you're not necessarily supposed to like because he is sort of this slightly uppity, annoying kind of college intern sort of kid. Like he that is his character, and it's not one you necessarily like, but he is entertaining, I think.
I mean, I would say he's probably got quite a good attitude, though. Like if you had Scooter in as an intern, he'd at least give it a good shot, wouldn't he? He's not lazy or anything.
Well, it's difficult to say because the thing that sort of is a bit off-putting about Scooter, especially early on in the show, is that he uses the fact that his uncle owns the theater as a kind of threat that hangs over Kermit's head in order to get his way. So there are many episodes where he wants a certain act to be on the show, or he wants to participate in something, and basically he threatens Kermit with eviction if he doesn't get his way. He's kind of underhanded as well. Like he will frequently sort of sell out various people who have taken him into their. You know, their trust. So, yeah, I mean, I don't dislike him, but I mean, there is something slightly untrustworthy about his character.
It's also worth noting that, like with many of the characters we talked about last week, he's quite bad at his sort of de facto job. He's not a very good sort of intern. And I think in one of his, I think it's early on in the show, in his one of his first tasks, he's sent by Kermit to get coffee. And he comes running back with the coffee and immediately spills it all over Kermit. So, you know, it's not as if he's, like, on top of the things that Mr. D said, he's also just bad at his tech job.
Right, as all of them are, yes.
Yeah. I didn't realize there was this level of rampant corruption because he didn't seem to be that. He didn't seem to be that underhanded in the episodes I watched. But
he's a New York college kid. You know, from East Sea. What do you expect?
This truly is a bit of deepest lore.
And like every sort of series like this, his character changes somewhat between the, you know, the sort of early episodes and the later episodes. So he is again, he becomes a little less abrasive as the series goes on. His uncle is always a kind of heel. He's always a kind of bad guy because he hates the show. And again, you know, you get the sense that that Kermit has difficulty keeping the rent paid. And so there, whenever JP Gross is on the show, there's a threat that the show is going to be evicted or that the theater is going to be demolished or, you know, something like that. So
he's a bit of a shyster. And, you know, I get the impression that 60s and 70s America was full of characters like this. Absolutely. I remember, you know, I was a big Bob Dylan fan, and I remember he had a manager at one point called Albert Grossman. Albert Grossman. And Dylan has a song called "Dear Landlord" that is, I think, aimed at Albert Grossman's kind of sharkish management style. Also, you know, I'm a Bowie fan. Wasn't Bowie part of this like management company called Main Man? And basically, like from 1969 until about 1979, Bowie didn't make any money really. Like he was
Yeah, that was the story with a lot of these acts. Yeah, certainly with Dylan and I think with Bowie. I don't know about that one.
So well, everybody has a go at Bowie for quote unquote selling out with Let's Dance and stuff in the 80s, but he's like, you know, I'm David Bowie. I need to make some bank, and my management company has ripped me off for the past 10 years. You know, I don't know what the name of the I forget the name of the Albert Grossman character, but it seems like there were characters like this all around in the 60s and the 70s, and that's something that I think maybe has changed a little bit, where there was a baseline distrust of people like this in the society. Whereas now that seems to be replaced with a kind of low level baseline trust among quote unquote normies of, you know, management executives, I suppose. Like this guy has disappeared and he's been replaced with some corporate suit who works for Sainsbury's or something, right?
Well, this is quite apt, I think, because JP, there aren't really characters like him or his inspiration around these days. Instead, what you have are people that, like, for example, he is presented as somebody who actually runs things, and he is sort of a boss. He's one of your car kings, I think. You know, that sort of person. Whereas, as you said, nowadays it would be some sort of middle manager in a vast, vast corporation that nobody really owns, as you point out, and they would come in and sort of try and spread wokeness or do sort of HR, you know, management. If it was nowadays, you wouldn't have a character like this. They're essentially gone.
Yeah, I mean, now that's the, you know, the CEO is like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Tim Cook of Apple, who has his pronouns in his Twitter bio. I mean, you wouldn't see JP Grossman or JP Gross putting his pronouns in his bio, you know. Although it is odd that the trope of this kind of character, this cigar smoking, suit wearing, you know, kind of JP Morgan type, it does sort of persist. I mean, there's still this idea of a kind of older white man smoking a cigar as being a symbol of this type of, you know,
it's Mr. Potter from It's a Wonderful Life is another kind of cigar.
Yeah. The Monopoly, the chap in the Monopoly game, you know, the 19th century, you know, capitalist, you know, robber baron type.
I think it speaks to the character of the left in a way that it doesn't matter how far you try to get away from that stereotype and how woke you become and how sort of, you know, touchy-feely you make your exterior, they will still caricature you as JP Gross, essentially. Yeah.
And I mean, Sowell talks about this in Conflict of Visions. He talks about how the left like to localize evil and embody it in in an individual, despite all of their talk of systemic this and systemic that. Actually, their view of the world is very cartoonish, where you get these cartoon villains. Whereas, in fact, the right, despite reputation, are actually the ones with this systemic view of things. It's kind of an interesting inversion if you read Conflict Division. Anyway, let us move on. Who is the next character, D?
Okay, the next group is actually a sort of group of characters called the Electric Mayhem. You will see that.
Oh yes, I remember these guys. Yep.
So I've chosen them for this spot because they are in every episode. I mean, one or more of them. Generally, all of them, but they appear almost in every single episode. Even though they they're sometimes in sort of intricately sort of involved in various plots on the show. But they also function, of course, as the house band. So there's Rolf, who we talked about last time. There's Rolf, yeah, who's kind of the piano, the kind of more of the classical jazz standard type. And then there's these fellows who are kind of the kind of 70s rock group. But they provide musical accompaniment for almost every sort of musical act on the show. So I thought that they would be the last sort of core group of characters that are on each episode.
And is that Animal, the drummer there?
Yes, that is Animal there on the left.
And I am correct in thinking, aren't I, that Animal is a bit of a kind of Phil Collins character. He's a breakout star from this group and goes on to be the best known of these characters.
Animal is fairly well known. You mentioned Phil Collins, but he actually was modeled on Keith Moon, the drummer of the Who, and actually all of these characters were modeled on real sort of musicians that we'll talk about as we go through them. But yeah, Animal did, I think, become kind of the most well-known of these characters in his own right. He is literally sort of treated as an animal. You can see in this photograph, he has a chain on his neck, which Dr. Teeth is holding the chain. And in many of the episodes, he does have a kind of iron collar and chain attached to him because he is sort of partially a beast. And anyone who's sort of familiar with his character will know. I mean, he, woman, you know, he's very animalistic, so to speak.
So he was an animal, a bloody disgrace, you could say. And then Dr. Teeth, who is he modeled on?
He is modelled on a musician called Dr. John, who I must insist that we have a picture of up on the screen because it sort of all becomes clear when you see what Dr. John looks like. I mean, I hadn't heard of this man before Mr. D pointed him out to me. Yeah.
This is Dr. John.
Yeah, right? That's Dr. John. Yeah. who passed on, I think, this year or last year, quite recently. Yeah. Yeah, so yes, Dr. Teeth was modeled on Dr. John. Panama Hat and I were discussing what exactly Dr. Teeth is. Again, this question comes up because they're sort of humanoids, but there is something, you can't see it here, but Dr. Teeth is very sort of spider-like. I mean, he has a sort of bulbous, round body, and his arms are very long and very spindly. You can see he's got those green hands. He is one of the Muppets that has articulate, like his hands are real hands. The puppeteer, like he is one of the Muppets that takes two people to operate, and so there are real hands inside his, you know, his green fingers, for him to be able to play the keyboard. He plays the keyboards in the band. So there is something very kind of slightly unsettling about his physical form.
And then we have on, is that rhythm guitar? No, lead guitar. Is it the Who's she modeled on? Is it Janis Joplin or the woman from...
So, that's Janis Joplin, and actually that character is called Janis. So quite deliberately. And so she is... her character changes. So in the first series, the puppeteer for her was a woman. I can't remember which of the puppeteers operated her. And then afterwards, the character was taken over by one of the main puppeteers called Richard Hunt. And he gave her a very distinct, very heavy Valley Girl kind of accent. Okay. So she's like, "Oh, for sure, Dr. Teeth." You know, she has that kind of character. So she's a bit of a kind of, you know, kind of California airhead type.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of who the other female singer songwriters of that era were. Joplin was a big one. There's a pretty famous who did that album like Blue.
Was it Carole King? Was it Carole King? No, that was.
I have to remember. Let me just have a look. Who did that? Because there's one of those female singer songwriters of that era that I associate with the worst type of kind of middle class pseudery. It's Joni Mitchell I'm thinking of.
Oh, Joni Mitchell, yes.
Oh God, Joni Mitchell is the embodiment of a certain type of middle class New York cafe culture. Woody Allen watching sued essentially, and I quite like Woody Allen films, but you know the sort of person I'm talking about.
I know the type.
You just have to see Joni Mitchell. I mean
the Diane Keaton character.
It's there's something about, you know, it's just you can just look at her face, and that alone tells you everything about the kind of Guardian Easter who would listen to that, and I use that as a metric to judge all sorts of things, Dee. If I tell someone I'm a Dylan fan and then they try to sidle into a Joni Mitchell chat, that loses you about minus 50 points.
Right. Yeah, see, I'm actually a huge Janis Joplin fan. I love Janis Joplin, but I know exactly the type you mean. Speaking of sort of female singer songwriters that era, one of the big ones, Joan Baez, was actually a guest on the Muppet Show during this run. Yeah, so Joan Baez appears on the Muppet Show, and again, of course, the relationship with Bob Dylan there. I think she's less of a kind of character which. You describe.
I think she's less. She is less egregious. And I'm just trying to. I had an English teacher when I was a 13, 14, who was a great. You know, you sometimes get strangely great inspirations in life, and this English teacher I had was, looking back, an obvious kind of 60s hippie hangover, right? And he used to do a lot of kind of crazy antics in the classroom, like headbutting the wall. We'd stay behind and talk about Nietzsche and things like in the breaks, you know. So he was a genuine inspiration to several of us in the class. And I remember he had a giant Janis Joplin poster on his classroom wall. So that's one of the memories that she triggers for me. I always get Joplin confused with another band of that era, and I just want to clear it up. Who is that band who does like White Rabbit and stuff like that? Is that
Jefferson Airplane? Yeah, that's Grace Slick.
That's a different singer, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now they were part of the same scene. I mean, I believe they were also sort of San Francisco based. I mean, that's where sort of Janis Joplin went, and where she sort of that scene which she arose from. But very different types, of course.
Yeah. So I swing back and forth on my view of that whole. While we're still focusing on Joplin, that whole San Francisco scene. okay, produced some amazing albums and some great music and some trippy music and so on and so forth. But I swing back and forth on whether it was just like the worst thing ever to happen in culture or actually something genuinely exciting. And one thing I would recommend that everybody watch, there's an Alan Wicker documentary where he goes to San Francisco in 1967 and he goes and talks to some hippies. And he's like, oh, Alan Wicker, here we are in San Francisco. What are the cool, young, groovy kids doing? It's quite a kind of an interesting look at how the BBC basically were treating that whole deal. And, the other thing I recommend everybody watch, it is, if you're a member of the channel, I think you can still access that through my channel somewhere. Although for some reason YouTube put a over 18 thing on it. And that is Why I Hate the 60s, on which Peter Hitchens is a talking head. And various miserable old sods like Hitchens point out that actually the 60s only happened really in about 1 square mile of London and about 1 square mile of San Francisco. I'm just interested in how we treat that. It clearly had a very long tail though. In the culture, because I think the 70s grows out of that whole San Francisco scene in a major way.
Well, yeah. if we're to take kind of a lesson from that, then let it be that it only needs to happen among a very small portion of the fashionable elite in order for it to basically change an entire world, you know?
Well, yeah, I'm probably at odds with a lot of the, you know, the sort of audience, because like, I actually have quite a fondness for this. I mean, I think it also helps that I didn't really live through it, even though I lived through a lot of the 70s, but I was certainly very, very young and not even in America at that point. But I have a great sort of fondness for a lot of these characters. As I said, I'm a big fan of Janis Joplin and such. I think that, again, with many artistic sort of movements, you have to separate the kind of political or sociocultural implications of it from the kind of artistic aspects of it, in order to not just, because otherwise you would just end up hating everything, I think, that came out of the 20th century.
An analogy I would make is that you don't have to be a 17th century Puritan to appreciate Paradise Lost. Right. Mm. You don't have to be a Cromwellian as John Milton was to appreciate that. And you could say the same thing of 60s psychedelic bands and so on.
Right. Let's move. Just a sort of last note on that. As I said last week, the Henson Miu, they were all kind of hippies. I mean, Henson was clearly a kind of very much a man of his era, and that kind of ethos does pervade the Muppet Show to a great extent. So, I mean, you know, again, that whole kind of, you know, the San Francisco or the, you know, just larger, the pop music scene and the kind of social scene of that era very much informed the kind of style of the Muppet Show. I mean, even though, I mean, you know, keep in mind that most of these shows are from 76, 77, 78, which would have been very late for this sort of thing. You know, I mean, by that point, Janis Joplin had been dead for almost 10 years. And so, you know, it very much was of a time that wasn't exactly, you know, the era that it was being made in.
This is probably a stream for another time, but I mean, maybe on another Deepest Lore, I'll do a, I'll do my breakdown of various 60s scenes, because one of the things I love about it, Dee, is what I'd call degrees of hipsterness, right? There's the kind of, you know, the Engelbert Humperdinck kind of mainstream 50s crooners, okay? Then there's the kind of big 60s band that everybody knows. Then there's the counterculture. Then there's the counterculture, like the Frank Zappa and the Captain Beefheart. And then, like, you know, if you really dig down to the San Francisco, I'm into a band called The Residents, who are kind of, you know, counterculture. And you get so many kind of layers of of this sort of thing. You also see it with the garage bands a little bit with the 60s, where you get on one level, like literally the Beach Boys, right? Or the Beatles, who came from playing those little clubs and so on. Then you get a band like the Troggs, right? Everybody knows, like, the Wild Thing and a few of their other hits. But then you get
Underground.
but then in that same garage scene, you get bands who like only ever managed to bring out a regional hit in the San Francisco area, or just in one, they had one hit and then they drift into obscurity. But retroactively, those sorts of bands gain a kind of mystique. So there's a hipsterness whereby, like, the more obscure and raw the act, and the more unpolished the act, the kind of cooler they get in a certain way. Anyway, let's keep on going round this band. Who is this character here?
Panama Hat, do you want to talk about him?
That would be Floyd, and as you can see, he has pink skin.
His full name is Floyd Pepper, by the way.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, very much wrapped up in all what you've been talking about the last sort of 10 minutes. I mean, it's you can even see he wears sort of military style coat there. You can almost, it's not very easy to make out here, but you can sort of see that.
He's wearing the Sergeant Pepper military, the sort of Carnaby Street mod version of the military uniform and he was modeled on John Lennon of the early 70s. So he wears the little, sort of military cap, and he has the sort of facial hair that John Lennon had for a period of time. So yes, hence the Floyd Pepper. Anyway, sorry, Panama.
I was actually about to say, I mean, this whole period and many of the tropes around it, I'm not actually that familiar with or sort of knowledgeable about. I mean, I think you probably more know than I would about this, Mr. Lee.
Yeah, I mean, but he is very much, I mean, if you ever hear this character talk, he is, we got the coolest cats around. He's very much, like, very heavy, sort of cool cat patois of, again, very much of the kind of late 60s, early 70s. This character is used a lot, and he often has kind of solo kind of private moments where he'll go into the dressing room of one of the guests and then they'll sort of have a jam. I think one of the highlights of the Muppet Show for me was his jam in the dressing room with Pearl Bailey, where they do a kind of scat singing number, which is quite amazing. But yeah, he's often used in that context, and he'll often have a breakout scene with Zoot, who's the character with the saxophone beside him, where they'll kind of do a kind of soulful duet. But
so who is Zoot based on? Is he Jerry Rafferty? I don't know.
I always forget, because it is not a musician I know. I would have to look.
One thing, just while that's being looked up, that I find interesting about these two is that, I mean, again, if this is a sort of hallmark of the period, then say so. But I mean, they seem to be kind of hangovers of the sort of experimental jazz sort of phase that was a bit before the whole, like, rocker thing. You know, the way they talk about, cool cats, man, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, Zoot is based on a saxophonist called Gatto Barbieri, who I'm not familiar with, but if you look up Gatto Barbieri, you will
that
see
a hell of a name
resemblance there.
Gatto, is that spelled like the cake?
No, it's Gatto, like cat in Spanish. Gato.
Right. Gatto Barbieri. Oh, here he is. Okay, let's look him up. Obscure character. This is what the deepest lore is about, OD, finding out really bizarre. There he is. There's Gatto. Oh, yeah, you can see. There he is. I wonder if it says it on his Wikipedia. He was the inspiration for Zoot.
I almost guarantee that it does.
Yep, there it is. He was inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, are you suggesting that this band is a little bit, reminiscent of this guy, the sorts of act who would be on the Far Show Jazz Club, you know this? Yes,
exactly. And I will say, unlike many of the characters on the show, these characters are always presented as being very good at what they do. The kind of bumbling character like Gonzo or Bunsen Honeydew or Fozzie, but these guys were always sort of presented as good, very good musicians. And the musical numbers, which of course were many of which were orchestrated and written and played for the show, are actually quite good. The music on the show is universally very good. I will say that they are an oasis of talent amidst a cast of mediocrity.
I don't know if there's a name for this, but I'll coin it myself here. I think Panama was touching on something else, which is that this is a kind of cultural moment that is, the way we'd think of it would be 10 years prior to when this show actually aired, right? What these characters are kind of gesturing towards. And I wonder if there's such a thing as cultural lag, right? Whereby the moment where we think something is popular actually has a very long afterlife. So that a band like this, who has all the iconography of kind of late 60s, is actually still knocking around in the late 70s. Then you could actually think about what was happening in the late 70s. And there were tons of acts, like they're still touring and going around and so on. So it did have quite a long afterlife.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this on one of the Deepest Lore episodes, where there is a sense where the kind of zeitgeist of a decade doesn't really happen until kind of midway through the decade. I mean, if you look at the early 1980s, it's indistinguishable from the 1970s. Even though we think of, of course, the 1980s going to be a big different sort of era. The 80s is this sort of neon and all of the kind of tropes that certainly the Zoomers with the vapor wave and all of that associate with the 80s. But that didn't happen until like 1985 or 86. Most of the 80s was spent as a kind of transition from the 70s, just as the early 70s were a kind of transition from the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, also people think of something like glam rock, right, as an early 70s phenomena. But really, the new romantics of the early to mid 80s, the Culture Club and Visage and all of those sorts of bands, They're just basically the mainstreaming of what had gone on like 10 years before, in a way. Yeah. I mean, there's some changes to the musical style, but I mean, they're all basically like kind of Bowie's children, if you want to put it that way.
And I think an interesting thing is, of course, there's a kind of meeting between this era, this kind of late 60s kind of era that the Electric Mayhem is sort of reminiscent of. But I mean, they are also guests on the show who are kind of part of the new wave, like Debbie Harry comes to mind,
Absolutely, yeah.
Or there are many references in the show to disco. They do many disco numbers and they, they get people like, I can't remember, like Cleo Lane and Diana Ross, performing kind of disco numbers. And so again, even though, that's very much of a kind of time that had passed a bit, they do have to interface with the things that came afterwards, which is quite interesting. Yeah.
And this is something else that we talked about last week a little bit, which is the fact that we're currently in what feels to me to be a cultural freeze, that since about the year 2000, we've been stuck in like Simon Cowell, X Factor land. Nothing ever seems to change. It's just the same. Like, I think X Factor has been on TV for literally 20 years or something. Like, all of these shows are celebrating their 15th, 16th, 17th anniversary. And it's all been the same, whether, the reality TV shows, the Big Brother, it's just like an endless cavalcade of this stuff. And, the reason I mention that is because if you take the 20 years, let's say between 1965 and 1985, or even 1975 and 1995, the sheer amount of stuff that changes and the sheer creativity of those periods and the developments in them are phenomenal when you think about it. Like, we're all of these movements we're talking about happened within 20 years of each other, whereas you look at the development of, I don't know, something like Outkast making an R&B song in 2003 and try to track the development of a modern R&B song that came out last week, and it's like, oh right, it's just the same old shit basically. I mean, that I see as a possible symptom that we're in this kind of moment of crisis where nothing nothing's really changing. Like the culture is in hostage.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yes, I do feel like there's this ossification of everything. I mean, not just not just popular culture, but just in the fine arts and in various musical scenes. I mean, there is this kind of sense that things just kind of stopped developing. I mean, and of course there's those who will say, well, everyone says that, everyone says, things weren't as cool as they were in my day. It's not about being cool. It's not about the fact that, that we don't like the things that are being produced. It's just like everything is now just kind of, it does have this sense that it all kind of paused, and it's just sort of stuck in a groove, to use an older vinyl record hipster metaphor.
Funny you should mention this, AA, because literally I think about 3 or 4 days ago, I picked up a book in my collection that was published in 1999, and it was a travel book. And this same thought occurred to me, that the styles and the kind of the art on the cover, there was even a small snippet of review on the back from what's his name, Bellingpole. There was like a little review there from him. I mean, it was like, there really hasn't been, across the arts, I think, there really hasn't been any sort of change, I think, as you pointed out, since for about 20 or so years.
In fact, all that's happened is that they've frozen it at that moment of time. And I remember it very well, because the millennium was a huge deal. Kids now will probably not remember it. And I was, 18 or whatever it was. Do you remember, I've told the story many times about Shaking Stevens in Cardiff, right? But I remember around that time they did an awful lot of best of millennium lists, right? But in actuality, so there was like the best album of the millennium, the best artist of the millennium, the best film of the millennium. Realistically, in music, what that actually meant was the best of, like, let's say 1960 to 2000, because there wasn't that much pre-60s stuff in those lists. That's a stream for another day as well, because I have my own theories about the almost ground zeroing of culture that happened in the 60s, almost as if there was nothing and then there was the 60s, right? That's not true. But still, there was a great celebration of the previous 40 years that had happened at that moment in the millennium. But since that point, what we had is almost as if things stopped at that point, and the only thing that people can do is to tribute that or to build on that. This actually comes into the things that we've talked about, all of these YouTube channels we've talked about, the SJWs and so on, because what the SJWs do is they take the cultural capital that has been built up in these things, and that was established at that moment of the millennium, where we were like, right, these are the best albums, these are the best films, and so on. And they've taken those properties or franchises or things that have been built up, and then they have just appropriated and stolen them without actually innovating. It's just a kind of straight theft, where you get now the pale pastiche of, just the woke version of the old thing, with this layer of political correctness on top of it. And in fact, the Mark Hamill Star Wars is probably a good example, right? It's like, well, you've taken a franchise that everyone loves, and now you've just kind of, reappropriated it for this moment, but you haven't created anything, right? Same with all the comics, same with all of the superhero movies, and the same in the music sphere, right? It's like, well, all of these things that were great, and now it's the first black person doing it too, or now it's the first woman too, right? It's just like, or now it's the first disabled trans kid doing it, or whatever. And I think they go hand in hand, the kind of ossification and lack of creativity with this kind of political agenda with it too, because it's an anti-creative, anti-independent movement, I would say.
Yep. And very much what happened to the Muppet Show. I mean, as I said last week, I really like the show. I really appreciated Jim Henson's work. But now, I mean, just going through a bit of the kind of stills from the current productions. I mean, they're still sort of making like new versions of the Muppet Show. I mean, they're awful. I mean, just it just sort of disgusting. You know, again, I have this feeling like, why can't you just leave this in the era where it came from with the people who created it, this fascinating little world, leave it there. Don't keep corrupting it. Don't keep giving Miss Piggy Botox, and don't have her, you know, have a kind of pan sexual relationship with, you know, don't ruin things of the past like this. Make something else. Move on. Yeah. But no, that's not what's going to happen.
Sorry, Panama, to move it past beyond a kind of level naught anti-woke analysis, right? I think we have to draw it back to the discussion we had about, Albert Grossman, or was his name J.C. Gross? And
J.P. Gross.
Yeah, J.P. Gross, and the difference between him and the middle manager. Because part of this phenomenon, and we can argue, like, what is the root cause? Is it the ideology, or is it the corporatization, right? Because that's what's happened. We talked last week about how Disney have taken over the Muppet franchise. And that's really what's happened. All of the cultural capital that we're talking about is now in the hands of four or five or six massive corporations who then have to put it through all of their different departments. I mean, one of my theories as to why R&B and rap, you know, I'm a rap fan, why they have basically frozen since the early 2000s, when, why have they been stuck in a loop? Part of the reason in my mind is because, whereas before you've got all of these little independent labels and they were doing exciting things and, you know, they were genuinely from the street and so on, now you've just got some massive corporation who will have a hip hop division with some suit who's in charge of signing hip hop acts. You know, that's very different from the startup, you know. So anyway, Panama.
Well, I mean, you covered some of the things I was going to mention there. And I was also going to say that, I mean, as you pointed out, it's to do with kind of corporatization. And also, I think that wokeness now has the monopoly on sincerity. So one of the kind of really enjoyable parts of the Muppet Show is that even when Jim Henson pulls out some old like music hall song from 1911 and gets the Muppets to sing it, like, even though there's an element of kind of, you know, piss taking happening there, at the end of the day, it's still, he's pulled them out because he sort of enjoys these songs, and you can see that. And there's sort of an element of, we're just going to come out here and sing a song, and you're going to enjoy it, and you're going to have a fun time, and then you're going to clap at the end. It's that level of sincerity that you just don't have now, unless it's about something woke, you know. And even then, it's not really sincerity because everyone's only doing it because they have to, right? You know, it's there just isn't that basic level of, we're just going to sit down and enjoy a song that's about something real. Or it's just a bit funny, you know. You can't do that now.
Yeah, and the Muppet Show was the work of a group of very talented, very off-center creative people who, again, had very free to kind of pursue their ideas, and that's what they did. You know, I mean, it wasn't by committee. There was no kind of analysis of you know, of the kind of market, you know, there wasn't any of that. It was just, again, a group of artists and writers who sat down and just created this moment. And I think that is in common with everything great and everything that sort of endures, and like Star Wars, this franchise just is burning the seed corn. You know, it drags on the fumes of that great burst of creativity that came from this extraordinary group of people. It will use that up until it is sucked all the life out of it, and then it will move on to something else and destroy that. You know.
Yeah, and I do think that the heart of what makes people human, I guess, and the heart of authenticity, is in what you're talking about, Mr. D. Whether it is a creative project or a business project or something, it's the small business. It's the thing they're trying to kill. Actually, it's the small enterprise. That's what is the kind of lifeblood of what drives new and exciting things. And what makes life worth living. And this is exactly the thing that at the moment that they're trying to drive out, right? They're trying it is the small businesses that are suffering and being closed down and being replaced with, the Borg, essentially.
Yeah, it is the individual versus the institution. And, the more localized something is, the more chance it has to be something sort of genuine and sort of creative, whether it be a business or an artistic project or whatever. And again, it's a metaphor that I think can extend from to everything in our time. It's the kind of narrative of our time, and we're watching it destroy the world.
It's perhaps also worth saying, I mean, it's quite interesting, quite funny that the Muppets has spurred this sort of thing on, but if we take a really long lens at this, then I think the kind of drought that we're now living through culturally is sort of the apex of liberal sort of capitalist, I think liberalism as a whole, I think it's we're just at the point now where there is nothing left. Liberalism rules the world. And we just have to sort of sit in the sort of, I don't even want to call them the ashes, because they're, it's still a structure. It's just completely sterile and vacant, really. It doesn't have any of the kind of so-called advantages that was supposed to, herald in this great new thing. It's just sort of been killed off.
I honestly feel like I mean, I don't want to come across as being too optimistic. And in fact, just before I came on stream, Morgoth sent me a funny email where he sent me a warning from a Spengler. Optimism is the hallmark of cowardice. but I feel like we are ready for a rebirth. That's what I think. I think the ground is ripe, basically, for something new to come out of what is dead. And it's funny, isn't it? Because you mentioned the sterilization of liberal saturation Panama had. Mm-hmm. We are now got to a phase where quite literally it is being sterilized by the pandemic, right? It's quite literally being sterilized. I've talked about the antibacterial wipes that I have to put on my shopping, but just the experience of going, I went to Sainsbury's yesterday, the whole experience of being there was just painful. The arrows on the floor, everybody wearing a mask, it's just this is not living, it is dying, right? It's dying.
Yeah, and I posted the other day a quote from Seneca the Younger, from the epistles to Lucilium. You're afraid of dying, but come now, is this life of yours any different from being dead already? And that is very much the feeling now, and you're right. I mean, these moments are often in history the things that preceded these great groundswells of change. So hopefully
Yeah, I mean, Douglas Murray wrote the book about Europe being tired, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago now? And now it's just like dead. So there's it's ready for something new. Anyway, let us move on. That was a oddly profound,
dark, introspective path there from the Electric Mayhem.
Getting very non-cozy. I will, but before we leave the Electric Mayhem, I will also point out that they all have very curious eyes. So of course, Animal is very famously has that very heavy brow, which he will move up and down. It can move the whole way down, so you can't see his eyeballs at all. And then he can open it very wide and make him, you know, it gives him his very distinctive look. But Dr. Teeth's eyelids are actually functionally those sunglasses. So, like, he moves those sunglasses move up and down as if they're his eyelids. So when he sort of like closes his eyes, it's the sunglasses. Janice, of course, never opens her eyes. She doesn't have any eyes. All you see are the lashes.
Large lashes.
Yeah, the same with Zoot. Under those glasses, and occasionally you will see, there is nothing. he just has the sunglasses. And Floyd, again, who looks like he's wearing sunglasses, his sunglasses actually blink. So those are actually sort of soft. Those are kind of made of a soft material, and part of the manipulation of that puppet is to kind of open and close those eyes, which look like sunglasses. So yeah, there's a very curious thing that they all have with their eyes that I've noticed. But that's a common thing with the Muppets, as we'll see in the next pair that we're going to speak about.
Who are?
Which is Beaker and Dr. Bunsen Honeydew.
Oh dear.
Okay, a lot of people were waiting for us to get to these two.
Yeah.
For good reason.
I'm not even sure where to start with these two. I mean, they feel like something from a different show. I mean, I know that stage sort of like science is a thing, but these two are something just utterly out of the end. You know, they're basically in a lab, and Honeydew will announce some grand breakthrough, or he'll perform an experiment that inevitably just ends in misery for Beaker and himself. And there are actually episodes where the entire sort of plot, if you can call it that, of the episode revolves around something caused by these two. So I think that's really why they're there, is for a bit of sort of, you know, a bit of kick in terms of what they can actually do.
It is one of those weird acts on the show that kind of blurs the line between television and, you know, because ostensibly the framing device of the Muppet Show is that they're producing this stage show, but then this is very much kind of a television thing, you know, to sort of have a science program like this. So exactly what they're doing in this small sort of Victorian theater is a mystery.
One of the things I was going to say about these two, especially the shot you've chosen here, is that to me this looks like science as imagined by kind of post-Dracula Bela Lugosi kind of early 1930s kind of science, you know, white zombie or something like that, where it's, you know, it's science as imagined by like 1930s Hollywood, isn't it?
Basically.
Yes. Yes, and of course, yes. I mean, all the sort of flasks and beakers, pardon the pun there, filled with colorful liquids. I mean, most chemical compounds are kind of a white crystalline powder, but it does very much have a kind of sort of mad scientist, and that's kind of what they are. I mean, they're kind of mad scientists, although I would say they're more daft scientists rather than mad. Again, the crux of every interaction is that they either try to do something that fails and ends up generally injuring Beaker in some grievous way, or they produce something that works, but it's something terrible that causes consequences for the other characters on the show.
You know, this is something I've sometimes wondered, though, coming back to our point about creativity, which is that are there any scientists that ever do just like quote unquote mad science? You know, rather than doing it for some like great, you know, great utility or some great breakthrough or trying to cure cancer.
There are. there are scientists that do that, and their main outlet, I think, would be TV. They appear on sort of History Channel shows from 10 years ago, where they would sort of do some crazy demonstration to prove a historical point, and they just privately funded madness.
That thing lives on YouTube, so there are tons of channels on YouTube. Nile Red I just can't think of anything. All of them. There are many, many channels, basically, where it's the channel operator doing various experiments or sort of. And some of them are absolutely mental. I mean, again, YouTube is filled with these people doing these terribly dangerous, amazing things. There is an endless supply of that content on YouTube. So I would say that the kind of adventurous aspect of the scientific, experience does live on YouTube to some extent, but of course it's something that has happened to science as well as happened to everything else, which is the institutionalization of everything. So the era of the great scientific generalist, in other words, a scientist like Michael Faraday or someone of that ilk who went through many different sort of areas of science, and these sort of great pioneers who kind of claimed large swathes of various fields of science. I mean, that's sort of over, and now science is mostly this kind of institute. Most of what scientists do is apply for grants. They're not in the lab, or at least not on the sort of higher levels of academic science. So yeah, I think it is also something that has happened in our age, and I say this with some sadness, because I used to be very much, when I was young, I was very much interested in science and very much looked up to, and even studied it for a period of time, very much looked up to this archetype. And now, again, I almost, when I hear the word science, I'm very cautious, because, again, it is another field that has been co-opted and is being used as a path to power. As it was in the past at various times, but still.
They're a priest class. The scientists have become a priest class, haven't they? And I think some of them have come to understand that in order to maintain that power, they have to espouse priestly values. Put it that way. And I'm of the view that this is all about to come to an end. That this is the final manifestation of what I'd call boomer truth, and we're about to experience an epistemic rupture, whereby the level of distrust with all of the authorities will be with all of the old authorities will reach a point where even basic assumptions will start to be questioned, which is why something like that Bronze Age Pervert book I was referring you to a couple of months back. Probably, I mean, I don't know how profound he is as a thinker, right? But some of the questions he is asking, I expect there'll be some very interesting kind of quote unquote discoveries to come in the next 10, 20 years. Like assumptions from the late 19th century that have now been taken as gospel and that are not questioned. I've got a funny feeling that there will be some sort of epistemic revolution when it comes to some of those assumptions being overturned once this priestly class has been swept aside. Anyway, let us have a look at another character.
One last thing on those two, because we didn't really talk about them as Muppets so much, but I think there's a real evidence here of the artistic acumen of the people that made this show. I mean, the character creation is incredible. You've got Honeydew, who, as you can see, has no eyes. He has no eyes whatsoever, or really any sort of face beyond the nose to rest his glasses on and a sort of small chin to make him look sort of portly. And then, of course,
the fact that they called him Bunsen Honeydew, I mean, it's a sort of stroke of genius.
It's bizarre. And I mean, you've got Beaker there, who is one of the darker characters on this show, because Beaker always has that cartoonishly frightened look. Look at the eyes popping out there and the mouth and everything and the hair. It's all kind of cartoonishly freaky. And then, of course, he's famous for the sort of beep, 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 beep noise that he makes. Yeah, but
he doesn't speak. He's one of the... There are a number of Muppets who don't speak, or they don't speak in any way that you can kind of comprehend. So, yes, as Panama Hat says, Beaker goes... Beep, 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 you know, and the other thing that Beaker does a lot is shriek. So, you know, because something terrible often happens to him.
And it's actually quite... The audio of him doing it is quite freakish because it is literally somebody just screaming in terror of their life. You know, it's sort of that.
Yeah, and as we said, terrible things happen to Beaker.
Yeah.
Has anyone made a dark kind of YouTube sitcom just focused on, like, the private life of Beaker? You know, when he's not working with Handsome Bunny Doo, like, how does he get on in life?
Very postmodern view.
Yeah, I'm sure Disney is working on. You know, right. Again, the other thing that's curious about them is what the relationship between the two of them is, because you know they're very. I mean, there is a very antagonistic kind of undertone to their relationship. It's very clear that Beaker is kind of the guinea pig for Bunsen Honeydew. But there are a few uncomfortable moments in the run of the show. In Panama Hat knows exactly what I'm talking about.
There is
one episode where I can't remember what precipitated it, but Bunsen Honeydew at some point says, "Ooh, Beaker, I never noticed how attractive you were," or something like that.
You're
like
similarly attractive.
It's so that there's a very weird undertone to that relationship.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, yeah, there are moments where there is just this horribly uncomfortable level of sexual attraction between these two, and it is really, really unsettling.
But again, that is the kind of thing that I am afraid the current moment would take and make part. I mean, I almost feel like Disney has made it canon that they're actually gay lovers, which would, you know, again, it's the kind of thing that I absolutely loathe and despise. I mean, What makes it so interesting in the original show is that, of course, you don't really know. I mean, it's never really fleshed out exactly why Beaker works for Bunsen Honeydew. Why does he put up with this kind of abuse and torture? Why is Bunsen Honeydew do any of this? I mean, I think the ambiguity of that is something nice. And, of course, our current moment cannot bear ambiguity at all.
Yeah, everything has to be explained.
That's something that I increasingly found with the current generation. The inability to deal with ambiguity and to let ambiguity lie as ambiguity is a serious problem. And I would call it the Harry Potterization of people's mindsets, where it's very black or white. It has to be good or bad. There can be no, like, we don't know. And this has been extremely destructive in, something like Shakespeare studies, right? It's been unbelievably destructive because you know the joy of or the richness of art, especially an artist as kind of deep and profound as a Shakespeare, is in all of those is in the kind of tightly balanced ambiguity of certain questions that are not answered and cannot be answered. You know, William Empson could not write a book like Seven Types of Ambiguity now, because it's not the right moment for it. Now it must be the moment of the... And it's ironic, isn't it, that at exactly that moment, the epistemology has broken down, because now we're in a situation where there are two opposing worldviews on certain empirical questions, and they cannot agree on very simple things like black or white, or, you know, who won the election.
Two plus two equals four.
I mean, on the point of this sort of hidden depth to certain things that we don't have anymore. I mean, another show that Mr. D and I have been watching in the mornings is Are You Being Served, which I'm actually seeing for the first time. I've not seen it before. And of course, in that, very famously, John Inman's character is, ragingly camp, but it's
Mr.
not
Humphreys,
really.
Yes.
If that was 2020, he would just be gay, right? He would be a gay man, and that would be the end of it. It wouldn't be funny. It's funny because even though he's outrageously camp, it's never actually stated he's gay. That's what makes it funny, is that he might not be, really. It's that sort of ambiguousness that for reasons of progressivism you just couldn't have now, because it would be seen as, you know, there would be some, you know, niche term for it, for that sort of character, I suppose.
Well, I mean, it's more than that. The modern Mr. Humphreys would crush the fun out of it by having to self-righteously affirm it as his identity.
Yeah.
And you must also positively affirm his identity, blah blah blah. Well, I mean, this is soul crushing. This saps the life out of all things. Because you cannot get to the underlying humor underneath. I was thinking that perhaps Will and Grace was the start of this, but I don't know. I'd have to think about it more. I always thought Will and Grace was one of the worst shows ever to air on American television.
Never watched it, so.
Who is the next character, Dee?
The next character is the Swedish chef. So you will find that on the Swedish chef.
Another character that blurs the line between stage and television.
This is again another one of those characters who many people said, "Oh, well, are you going to get to this character?" Because many people will remember and associate this character with the show. He is again another one of these sort of characters who doesn't speak in a language that anyone can understand. He's called the Swedish Chef, so he is. You would assume that he is Swedish, but there is actually an episode of The Muppet Show where one of the guest stars, I can't remember who it was, actually speaks Swedish, and confirms that the Swedish Chef is not actually speaking Swedish. So, you know, it's weird. There is a very weird ambiguity to again what this character is and where he's from and what he's doing there. He is very much like Bunsen Honeydew and Beaker in that he is absolutely terrible at what he does.
Yeah,
generally his cookery results in disaster of the one sort or the other.
Does he have eyes? Since we've
talked about eyes. Again, another character that has no eyes. He just has brows. he has no eyes. Occasionally you see him without the hat, and he is bald. He does have a bald head under the chef's hat, but he's generally pictured wearing his chef's whites, like that.
I would say the Swedish Chef is one of the characters who, because one of the things about the Muppet Show is that there's a general level of anarchy and chaos to proceedings, okay? Mm-hmm. And there are certain characters who up that, right? Beaker is one of them. Animal is one of them. And I would say the Swedish Chef is another character who ramps up the level of chaos in the show, because usually... when he's around, there'll be all sorts of clattering and high energy antics going on.
Yes, and he actually, every one of his sketches begins with him singing the very famous song that everyone hears for skidoo, and then he generally is waving utensils around, which he throws behind him, which often, like, you can see those cups and saucers in the background. Often the utensils he throws will hit some of those and they'll fall and smash, you know. Bork, bork, bork. And he often fires a gun during the course of his sketch. So many of the Swedish Chef sketches involve him shooting something.
The recurring joke is that he throws, like, an uncooked bird into the air, shoots it, then of course it comes back down as like a cooked turkey or whatever. Something else with the Swedish Chef is that he is sort of like, again, as you said, he's sort of like this agent of chaos in this, but his interactions with the rest of the crew and all the rest of the Muppets are very strange, because he doesn't have much of a sort of backstage life like many of the main cast do. And you only ever really see him in the sort of canteen that they apparently have, that he cooks in. And there's kind of very little justification for him to actually be there.
Exactly. It's sort of a cookery stage show, yeah. Or he cooks in the canteen.
Yeah. And also, just a credit to the names that these Muppets are given, Swedish Chef. Like, you know, that was a name they gave him in draft, and they stuck with it. Like,
just became his name. Yes.
Yeah, Swedish Chef, contrasted with a name like Bunsen Honeydew, which has been, you know, like it's just the bizarreness of this show.
Yeah.
I should mention here, this is not a diss on her, but I've often accused Mrs. A of being a Swedish chef, not because not because she's bad at cooking, but because whatever Mrs. A makes, be it just a cheese sandwich or a cup of tea, somehow it results in the entire kitchen and all of the pots and pans and things somehow being used. I've never met anyone who manages to somehow use like five different pots, you know, making like, you know, what did you make? Oh, a bowl of soup. How did you manage to use four different pots? You know, every single utensil. Like, how does this happen every day?
An insight into the married life of academic Asians.
I will also note that the Swedish Chef is unique amongst the other Muppets in that he is another a Muppet that requires two puppeteers to operate him. So the one puppeteer, Jim Henson, is generally the operator, and Jim Henson was the voice of the Swedish Chef. Henson will operate the head and one of the hands, and then another puppeteer will be the other hand. But unlike all the other puppets that have sort of real hands in gloves, there are no gloves. It doesn't show in this picture, but the Swedish Chef's hands are literally like Jim Henson and the other puppeteer's bare hand. So he has like real human hands attached to him, and there is something slightly freakish about that. He's also large. I mean, you don't really get a sense, but I mean, this puppet is his head is slightly larger than kind of a human head, so it's a he's a very large thing. So the hands are in scale, but there's something. I would assume you would agree there is something slightly weird about his real hands.
Creepy, yeah, to see him there with these real hands holding things. Especially since they're not the same pair of hands, which is often quite obvious. You know, the different, slightly different skin tone and sort of look to each hand is very unsettling.
Yeah, but and he also often has to threaten other Muppets or chickens or hapless birds, lobsters, with his cleaver. He's often waving a sharp meat cleaver about and, you know, and running after something and trying to kill it. So,
yes, and
very chaotic character. Yes,
interesting fact about him: he in every country the Muppets is shown, he is the Swedish chef, except Sweden, where he is the Norwegian chef. and apparently it's still not really, most Swedish people aren't really aware that in every other country he is Swedish, and they're all having a great laugh at him being Norwegian.
And one side bit of deep lore about the Swedish Chef is way back in the dim and distant past, when Google was not evil, they had a little Easter egg on the search called Bork Bork Bork, which you could click, and it would translate any web page into Swedish Chef fake Swedish. I don't know. They may still have that somewhere where you can do that. But I remember, like, the early 2000s, Bork 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 was one of the language translation options. So,
yeah, I remember all those cool tricks you could do with Google back in the day.
Who is the next character, D?
Next character is Sam the Eagle.
Oh, I like this guy.
Yes, this is resident right winger of the Muppet Show.
Very curious. Yes, Sam the Eagle is. I mean, he's literally the resident right wing character on the show. His job on the show is ostensibly as the censor. So he is the resident censor of the show, and I guess sort of took that role upon himself. I don't think he was hired to censor the show, but he is the Muppet Show sort of cultural attaché and upholder of traditional values and enemy of weirdness. He often refers to his weird mission as weird. As to remove weirdness from the show and bring back wholesome, uplifting cultural values.
So he's an ironic hero of the Muppet Show, is what you're telling me.
from our point of view, yes, it would seem.
Yes, I'm convinced that they literally made him look a little bit like Richard Nixon,
and sound as well.
Yes, and his if you've ever heard him talk, he's a little like, you know, he does have a little bit of that kind of Nixon, that Nixon quality to him.
I bet you, yeah. Sam the Eagle was schooled in the Trivium. He'd have done Foundations of Writing, now available on pre-order.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, Sam the Eagle can be a hero, but he is also, like many of the other Muppets, he's a slightly tragic character in that his best laid plans are often thwarted. You know, he often fails, or he becomes kind of misguided, and in the end result is that, yes, the whatever he had planned to do or whatever he had planned to present as the kind of, you know, uplifting non-weird content for the show goes awry. As Panama Hat could probably.
That's Jim Henson's gentle and extremely subtle commentary on the neocon co-option of the right-wing agenda in America.
I mean, there's also the fact that he is revealed to be basically like I don't want to say precursor, because this is a trope that's existed, you know, it's as old as the Bible practically, but you know, the kind of like sad, almost like what would be in modern parlance, like a neckbeard, whose only life exists, say again, nowadays would be on the internet where they talk about like fascism. They're really into fascism, or they're like a hardcore moral conservative, or they're a communist or something, you know, like some rich, all they do is like hark some sort of ideology to people that don't really care for it, but outside of that they have no life. And there is an episode, I can't remember which one it is, where I think it's revealed that like he has like no real, like his wife and kids left him or something, or
yeah, that's
like
that's one of the pilot episodes where that is given as a backstory. It's never referred to again. I don't think they ever mention him being married or anything again. But I think of him being like very much like a Peter Hitchens character. You know, there's a sense that he's lost the battle, and he is just sort of sifting through the ashes of the show.
I have to mention this, Dee. Sorry, he actually looks a little bit like Peter Hitchens as well. But on tomorrow night's Deepest Lore, I'm going to be reviewing bits of Pete Hitchens' brand new book. So if you're interested in that, that'll be tomorrow at 9. Carry on.
About him being like Peter Hitchens. I would really take issue with that, because Peter Hitchens is somebody who is authentic in this. And he's also, Peter Hitchens isn't really sad, I wouldn't say. He's, you know, he's got a kind of life outside of just like harking moral conservatism, whereas the Sam the Eagle not only has no life outside of this, but he doesn't actually know anything about traditional culture. He
yes. constantly gets
wrong. He doesn't know who William Shakespeare was or what he wrote. He doesn't know anything about, like, every single subject he touches upon. He demonstrates a complete lack of knowledge.
Yeah, he likes the idea that he is the upholder of culture and tradition, but then when faced with it, he often doesn't know what to do, or doesn't know, have any idea what it's about. You know,
this character unfortunately wouldn't work today. You'd have to replace him with a slightly officious kind of middle aged woman, wouldn't you? Espousing wokery as opposed to traditional values, because otherwise the kids wouldn't believe it, because this character no longer exists in
culture.
I think if sort of liberal left people made this show today, Sam Neill would basically become like Nigel Farage. Like that's what he would be, I think. Just somebody going on about immigrants and making the country, you know, good to live in again or whatever. That would be
the thing is it's a very gentle parody, because of course he is also like all the other ones. I mean, he is part of the kind of the family of the show, so to speak. And I mean, he does participate in other ways. He's occasionally in the kind of musical numbers, or he'll sing along with, you know, with something. So he isn't sort of presented as a villain. Like he's just another one of them, which I think is a very different way than than he would be handled, if this type of character would be handled in a contemporary program.
He's also correct that the Muppet Show is weird.
We've probably got time for one more character, Dee. So who are we going to look at?
What do you think, Hat?
Unless we can do too quickly. I mean, how can we?
I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of ancillary characters like Robin the Frog, who is Kermit's nephew, and Beauregard, who is the janitor character. There's Link Hogthrob and Dr. Julius Strangeport. Perhaps we should talk about the pigs. Yeah, so you will see a file called Pigs in Space.
Alternatively, we have Statler and Waldorf.
We talked about them last week. Yeah.
Oh, yes, we did, didn't we? Just going to scroll through these slowly.
Who's that?
That is a character called the Dog Lion. There's a whole category. If you look up if you open the file called Fog.
Fog. Some of these pictures are really
great. That's George the Janitor. Yeah, there's Gonzo.
Fog. You might want to just click off there, scrolling through each one.
Well, no, I thought we'd hit points of interest, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
I mean, we talked about here.
There's New Zealand. That's the Jug Band. That's who are in many of the musical sketches.
Who's that?
Oh, that is Marvin Suggs and the Muppethone. So this sketch, appears. They do this quite a number of times throughout the series. Basically, this man has a mallet and these small sort of cuddly tribble-like things. He hits them with the mallet and they emit a musical and he plays songs by beating these small things. Yeah.
It's also an Italian,
very dark character because he likes that's the old George the Janitor and there's the old piggy.
Michael
Parkinson.
More piggy, the audience.
Yeah. Oh, I saw. I've seen this guy as well. I love this guy's set, by the way. I love that set. For some reason.
Yeah, he's the Muppet News, the newsman. He's never given a name, but his sketches basically involve a very obvious joke every time. There's Robin.
Rizzo becomes a big character in the movies, doesn't he?
He's not so much in the show.
Appears in season 5. I don't know if that one is Rizzo. I mean, there are the rats appear throughout the show, but they only become kind of distinct characters in the last season and then in the films. And that's Robin, the depressed nephew of Kermit, who often sings very doomer songs. Yeah.
There's
not sure what is happening there.
These are amazing pictures.
Sweetums. So Sweetums is one of the monsters. So he would go with Dog Lion, who is the character you pulled up, and then Thog, which you will get to if you keep scrolling through. There's Thog. That's actually the operator of one of the monsters. So you can see how large that's Thog, the huge blue thing. You can see how large that puppet is.
So it's enormous.
Yep.
Yeah. Keep going. I think there's another picture of Fog. There he is. Yeah. So yeah, there are these class of Muppets which are like full body costumes with articulated sort of heads, and they appear in many many of the sketches. You know, these sort of big terrifying monsters.
I feel like Fog was ripped off by Monster Munch. One of the Monster Munch monsters looks a lot like that.
Mr. D's favorite brand, I believe, of crisps.
I don't know what you're talking about. Yes, Thog.
With munching Monster Munch. I mean, this character. Oh, there's Uncle Deadly. He's very well dressed. I very much admire his style. But yeah, Thog, that enormous thing, appears in the intro. Quite famous. I don't know how, but they get him to run out onto the stage and do the intro. I have no idea how that works.
Yeah. The monsters are a sort of staple of the Jim Henson universe, and there, there is a strange thing where many Muppet sketches involve one of these monsters eating another Muppet. Yeah. Which there's a troubling subtext to some of these things, but
yeah. Now, we believed for a long while that this was part of some sort of fetish on behalf of Henson or somebody working on the show. The amount of people, and it is actually terrifying. Like, every sketch pretty much ends in somebody being swallowed by something, which, if anybody spent a bit of time in the darker parts of the internet, knows is something of a community. But it's apparently the reason for this is quite innocent. It's simply because they would come up with these zany things that they couldn't end. And so Henson would flip a coin. And depending on if it was heads or tails, there would either be an explosion, everything would explode, or they would just get eaten by something. That would be.
So it was a Monty. Monty Python debate, because Python had that problem, didn't they? And famously, they just said, "Oh, no, for something completely different," because they couldn't think of how to
finish. Yeah, now it's time for the penguin on top of your television chat to explode. Yes.
And as Henson has a bit of a thing for bringing on like a female singer as the guest or some sort of woman star, and then he will have them do a number with these enormous monsters just sort of walking around and doing some sort of like act with them. Like, it all of the female acts seem to have a number that involves these things for some reason.
No, just before we finish, who is this character here?
Uncle Deadly, my favorite of the costume.
So Uncle Deadly appeared very early in the show as a subplot. There was an episode where there was a Phantom of the Muppet Show, and basically it was this character who was presented as being the ghost of a performer who had performed at the theater and who had died because he was killed by the critics. During a performance of Othello, I think he said, he sort of is in one episode, and then he kind of returns occasionally. Henson just sort of uses him as a kind of stock weird character. He kind of got a life, later on, outside of the canon. I think he's used very frequently in the current incarnation of the Muppet Show, where he's kind of presented as a kind of gay style icon, sadly. Really? But he does appear in the original show, yes, and he's a sort of well-dressed, slightly moth-eaten
Very scary.
Yeah, I mean, there is a thing with there are quite a few of the Muppets who are quite terrifying, actually.
I mean, with him, I mean, he looks to be like some sort of Chinese dragon that's been just made to look even weirder. You know, that's what's brilliant about him, is that he's one of these things that you're never really sure what they're meant to be. And I mean, he has all those strange white things protruding from his head that may be hair or maybe something else. You just don't know. And I mean, I was when I first saw pictures of this guy, I was very impressed by his style. there's one of him in that brown coat and a white waistcoat and a red tie, which is a style I've now taken up because it just looks very good.
That in Spitting Image, didn't they? The reuse of a named puppet, if you wanted to put it, and then like later on, so. I don't know, like in late 80s, early 90s, Spitting Image, you'll see like, you know, Brezhnev or whoever it was, like crop back up, you know, they're just using them as a background minion, like, or generic Russian or whatever. But
yeah, and that was something that Henson did a lot. I mean, you know, many of these numbers would involve like, you know, several dozen of the Muppets sort of singing along. And so, you know, they just sort of, it seemed like they sort of grabbed whichever ones they, you know, they could. Although this Uncle Deadly one, it does tend to appear in like with guests such as Vincent Price and Alice Cooper. Like he will appear with a kind of spooky guests. So
mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, you wanted to mention one last thing, Dee, before we get out of here.
Yeah, I mean, just you scroll through the bottom. If you go up to the top, there's a couple of notable things, notable characters that we'll just touch on briefly. So if you go up to Bobby Benson and the Babies.
Oh, no. This is a grim
we wanted to mention this because I think that this character, like this group of characters, is my least favorite on the show.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you agree, Panama Hat.
I can't stand these creatures. These are repulsive to look at. They're never that funny. And I just want them to be off the screen whenever they come on.
Yeah, there's something very dark about it. It's a group of sort of humanoid babies.
Yeah.
And they are led by that very shady looking character called Bobby Benson, who who is often smoking a cigarette. And you can't see it there, but he brings them on, and these babies will sort of play a musical number. They're quite belligerent generally. These babies, they're violent. They will sort of hit people. They will interrupt things. They savage each other, and they're just very unpleasant characters. And any time that the babies, or we would see the babies, it's like, oh no, not the babies. But there's some very dark kind of undercurrent with the Bobby Benson and the babies.
I would say this is the one part of the Muppet Show that objectively hasn't aged well. Like, there are people that will say, oh, this politically incorrect humor, but I don't, you know, we didn't care about any of that. That's only if you're a leftist. But this, I think, because of the amount of time paedophilia now takes up in the zeitgeist of the West, this particular thing has aged very poorly. He's clearly meant to be a kind of creepy weirdo that would have a coterie of infants around him, you know, very dark. Very upset.
Dark. Yeah. Anything else, Dean?
No, and I think the last image, a good one to sort of hold up at the end, if you have any super chats or anything, is the one country trio. So these are actually Muppets of Jim Henson, Frank Oz, and Dave Goles, Jerry Nelson, who are three of the kind of core Muppet performers. These are literally Muppets of themselves. And they periodically appear on the show doing a kind of, you know, sort of country, as their name implies, a country trio song. But I think it's something sort of nice about the fact that, and they will also appear as background characters. So you'll occasionally see the Jim Henson Muppet or the Frank Oz, who's the ginger with the bass, or Jerry Nelson. You will see these Muppets being used again as a kind of background minion. So it's sort of a nice little kind of self-insert of the performers and creators of this madness.
He's got a kind of Chris Christopherson look, doesn't he? This one on the left.
Who, I believe, was a guest, wasn't he?
Yeah, yes, Chris Christopherson was one of the guests, yes. And Rita, his wife of the time, Rita Coolidge, yes.
All right, let me get these super chats then, because the time is upon us. I think it's been fascinating. And who'd have thought that Muppets would lead to the sorts of conversations we had?
I'm very glad the Muppets have sort of unlocked sort of dark realizations about modern society via a sort of crazy semi-kid show.
Apologies. I do think that there is a sizable contingent of people who were here for the cozy factor. So I do apologize when we strayed away from coziness for minutes. But I think it was necessary conversation to have.
Well, you can't avoid it. You can't avoid it with the Muppet Show and anything from sort of pre this era smacks of kind of reactionary fervor just because it wasn't made today.
Yeah, and speaking of that, next week I think we're going to do on the Deepest Law. We're going to do Pharaoh is going to come back, and we're going to do Christmas ads, and then for the two following weeks, I've got an idea of just watching archival footage of like 50s and 60s London, 50s and 60s mm-hmm. America, real life home videos wherever I can find. I'm going to be just watching them. With these sorts of things in mind, to see the sorts of things that you spot in the important thing is that it's uncurated footage, uncurated archival footage. So that is what I'll be digging into in the next few weeks. All right. So Professional Reality says, Alexa, play Dispatcher. Well, that had you, Professional Reality. I'm not in that room today. So there we go. Lord Albine says, I'm here. Greetings from Night City. Greetings, Lord Albine. Household Dog says, actually, not only was culture frozen, but it was homogenized. Now you get rap, trance, dance, rock, and R&B in one song. In the 90s, the hardcore fans of these genres generally despised each other. Yes, very true, Household Dog. I noticed a lot of people in the chat were surprised to learn that I am a rap fan. Must be newer fans. Maybe one day I'll do a whole deeper store on rap. The depth of my 90s rap knowledge will surprise some.
Of course, if they want a taste of what your rapping might be like, they could perhaps, you could release that old album of songs by your close friend that were recorded back in the day.
Now, one thing I remember, I'll just share this with you. As you may know, I come from a small town in Wales, and I remember this this guy who was either in the year below us or the year above us, I can't remember quite which now. He went to live in New York, and this is around, let's say, 1994, 1995. He went to New York for like a year, and then he came back, right? And it was the funniest thing. He came back, and he had like the shades, and he had the you know, like the boom box over his shoulder. And he was walking, you know, down the street outside the local library and supermarket with the boom box playing rap, you know. I'll never forget that. That was an example of a fish out of what he was trying to bring, like the hood back to small town Wales, you know.
The valleys would never be the same.
Lee Collier says, for the Twitter treads and the headache, this stream will give you YouTube code breakers. Hold the line. Thug Life Bear says, here's a fiver for D to tear apart Business Insiders. Why modern art is so expensive. Art isn't about beauty. It never really was, really. So,
controversial opinion there.
We'll have to get back into that when we return to modern art as a enduring topic of this show. King Cribble says, the Lord of the Rings Amazon series has just revealed a healthy serving of black and brown cast members, one being Lenny Henry. Who's Lenny Henry playing? Aragorn? Who's he playing?
I did notice that Lenny Henry is in that cast. He was one of the few people that I recognized in that cast video, but I don't know who he's playing.
Who's he playing?
Gandalf
no idea.
The Black.
Lenny Henry, Lord of the Rings. Who's he playing in Lord of the Rings? Tom Bombadil? I mean.
Bombadil.
Saruman.
I mean, AA, this speaks to what you pointed out earlier, that just endless rebooting of franchises. When we're now going to have, what is this, like the fourth major adaptation of Lord of the Rings, and it's going to have blacks in it now? You know, there's
it doesn't actually say who he's going to play. I mean, Bilbo Baggins.
I see, just for the meme, I kind of want to see Lenny Henry as Bilbo Baggins, like just for the sheer absurdity of it. Like it I don't know anymore. I can't even be angry. It's just funny now. It's
Gollum. I think I'm going with Gollum.
I mean, I have no interest in that series because I have the controversial among some view that they were already done perfectly. I know, like, hardcore Lord of the Rings fans had problems with the film, but I honestly think the 13-hour special extended plus edition, I think it's amazing.
Yeah, I think those films, again, they're not the books, but I think that is the best, the absolute best that anyone could ever do with that material. I think it would be very difficult to top those films.
Yeah, I mean, that could be a deepest lore stream one day as well, because that is one of the few times I remember going to the cinema, and just my head was buzzing for days after watching Two Towers for the first time. That battle at the end of that, nobody had seen anything like it at the time, and that again is something that feels like it's like, well, it does happen actually, but it only happens in the realm of politics now. That's where, like, my mind is being blown with what happens in politics every day. I very seldom see a film that knocks my socks off like that. I still can't find who Lenny Henry's actually going to be playing. He's just a cast member, right? So there we go. Apparently it's a spin-off series, not the actual Lord of the Rings, so that could save it, I guess.
Well, we saw how well that worked for the Hobbit films, so I don't know.
Do you know? I went to see the Hobbits on an all night. I saw the whole trilogy in one night.
Oh,
so that was a very long night at the cinema. Yeah.
At least you could get some quality sleep. Yeah. Well, one of those films. I can't recall which one, but it's the only film I think I've ever fallen asleep watching at the cinema.
Yeah, they are a bit honorary.
So I mean, that's one thing. I'm a little bit upset that they're touching Lord of the Rings, because that was the one kind of holdout of, I would say, deep hidden reactionary culture. And you know, the Eye of Sauron, the SJW Eye of Sauron, spotted that, didn't they? Did you remember that Guardian article I shared before? They spotted it, and they and now, lo and behold, they are remaking it in their own disgusting image.
Well, I think it's also probably pertinent that I think it was Christopher Tolkien. Did not he pass away fairly recently?
Oh, so he was after he died. You know,
well, yeah, which may be why, you know, now he's no longer there to protect. Protect the legacy of that.
They'll do something atrocious, like give the orcs feelings or something. You know, be like, think about it from the orcs' point of view.
Hey, do you remember? I'm pretty sure it may have been this year. Actually, there was some Guardian article, or maybe it was a Times article that came out that said that the Lord of the Rings was this sort of dangerously reactionary piece of work, The orcs are meant to be like, you know, the masses that have to, you know, in a Marxist sense or something.
Yeah, you know, that's what I was referring to. That as the Eye of Sauron spotted it, you know, that it was this one, you know, one lovely little slice of secret medieval heroic culture that Tolkien had embedded in the culture as a lovely site of resistance against the modern world, if you want to put it that way. And now they've got their beady little eyes on it.
Christopher Tolkien, I just looked, died in January of 2020, and so I think that his death probably is the reason that now the legacy, there's nothing standing between the legacy of Tolkien and the merchants of corporate wokeism.
It's disgusting. Gamesy, I've got nothing against Lenny Henry being in it, by the way. It's just what I know they'll do to it, you know.
Yeah.
Game Z Makara says the true Muppets were the friends we made along the way. Owen Kapler says Daily Shill for the Eastern Romans, good streams. And Yiz the Eunuch says Liquid Swords by Jizza is my fave rap album. Well, Yiz the Eunuch, you've got very good taste, because Liquid Swords by Jizza Genius is probably the best rap album of all time by anybody. All right. So let us leave on that note. Thank you very much, gentlemen. This was tremendous. Next week, I'll be back with Pharaoh to look at Christmas ads. And it's going to be horrible, by the way, because then we're looking at modern Christmas ads, like of the John Lewis variety. He's already told me that they're already looking horrible for this year. So that'll be fun. And then the week after that, we'll be looking at archival stuff. Tomorrow night, I will be back. We're on Cigar Stream looking at Peter Hitchens' new book. And me and Dee will be back next Tuesday, won't we, Dee, for Unpopular Opinions. And it will be the end of year awards, which is our lovely little sidestep of actually talking about the election, which YouTube have just banned. So, you know, that means we'll get to focus on the awards for a stream rather than, the malarkey, as it were. Or we'll have to find code names like the Shadow King and God Emperor and so on and so forth. All right. Foundations of Writing is available on pre-order now. Several, I think 10 people have already signed up for that. So I'm feeling a bit of pressure to get it finished now, Dee.
You got pre-orders to fulfill. Yeah,
well, exactly. It's like a lit a fire under me a little bit. And yes, I will see you all soon. Get out.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
How does Kermit say goodbye?
Goodbye. I'll see you next week on the Muppet Show! Yeah.